From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson. Robin is off today. It's Here and Now. President Trump continues his visit to Asia today in Da Nang, Vietnam. He met with leaders of the region at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit and shook hands with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Trump also addressed trade at the summit and reiterated his America First policy.
From this day forward, we will compete on a fair and equal basis. We are not going to let the United States be taken advantage of anymore. I am always going to put America first, the same way that I expect all of you in this room to put your countries first.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn is following this from Beijing. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Jeremy.
So the 21 economies taking part in this summit account for 60% of the world's GDP. 12 of the countries had been part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, which President Trump pulled the U.S. out of. What more did the president have to say to them?
Yeah, as you heard in his message, he was basically saying, we're not going to be taken advantage of again. And this is a message that he's been conveying for a long time. Basically, he's saying we want reciprocity in our business agreements. The U.S. Is going to have its markets open and give a level playing field to other countries' companies, and the U.S. expects the same. But there was a tone of grievance in what he was saying. He's basically saying, you know, we embraced certain countries into the world, the global rules of the World Trade Organization, but these countries didn't follow the rules. They dumped their products on foreign markets. They manipulated their currencies. They stole intellectual property. Now, it was very clear that he was talking about one country in particular, and that's China. But
right.
He didn't mention them by name. It was very clearly about China, but he was reflecting the view of U.S. companies who feel they're not getting a fair shake in China.
He used the term Indo-Pacific to describe the region. What's the significance of that?
Okay, that's a new policy. A vision of the regional order that the Trump administration has just come out with. It's basically a military alliance with India, Australia, and Japan. And it's supposed to uphold what they call the rules-based order in the Asia-Pacific region, which they now have relabeled the Indo-Pacific. It's about the rule of law, about individual rights, which you can also understand as human rights, and about protecting the freedom of navigation and overflight in the region. And once again, this is a space that China fits into perfectly, and China feels this is a way of containing it, hedging against its rise, and basically very close to the previous Obama administration's pivot to Asia policy, except with some differences. Now, the pivot to Asia had a military component, which is shifting American military assets to Asia. It had an economic component, which was the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, and it had a diplomatic component. The Trump administration, meanwhile, has slashed the budgets and the staffing in the State Department, and it has walked out on the TPP. So that basically leaves the military part.
Now, the Chinese leader Xi Jinping spoke moments after President Trump. What did he say?
Well, he basically portrayed China once again as the champion of globalization and open economies and the foe of protectionism. And part of his plan for that is, of course, the so-called Belt and Road or New Silk Road Initiative, which plans to invest billions of dollars in infrastructure linking Europe and Asia. And also it comes with a trade pact, which could supplant the TPP. It's called the Regional Economic Comprehensive Partnership, and it's basically China behind the wheel with that.
Now, President Trump will travel to Hanoi tomorrow. Vietnam, obviously a place with a lot of historical importance for Americans. What's the relationship between President Trump, the Trump administration, and Vietnam?
Well, you know, Trump has a personal history with Vietnam, and that is that he was exempted from military service during the Vietnam War because of a bone spur. That said, you know, a lot of Vietnamese are actually very keen on Trump. They like him. There was a Pew survey earlier this year that found that 58% of Vietnamese like Trump, and that's compared to a global median of 22%. We have to also mention that growing tensions between Vietnam and China play a part in this. And it's very interesting that in his speech today, President Trump mentioned a couple of historical heroines in Vietnamese history, the Trung sisters. who were part of a Vietnamese rebellion against Chinese invaders in the year 40 AD. Never mind that these sisters were also the precursors of Vietnamese who fought the Americans in the 1960s and 70s, but this was clearly a reference designed to make them think about how they kicked out their Chinese occupiers at the time.
That's NPR's Anthony Kuhn joining us from Beijing as President Trump continues his trip to Asia. Anthony, thank you.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
Well, in Washington, several Republican lawmakers have come forward saying that Alabama Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore should step down if sexual misconduct allegations against him are true. He denies the claims reported in the Washington Post that he initiated a sexual encounter with a woman decades ago when she was just 14 years old and he was 32. Meanwhile, comedian Louis C.K. is also facing backlash this week after multiple women came forward to accuse him of sexual misconduct. And these are just some of the recent sexual misconduct claims that have surfaced against men of power, including sexual harassment allegations against NPR's vice president for news, who was forced to resign last week. Let's check in on how social media is reacting with Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Jeremy. Definitely a theme going on right now.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable, just day after day after day. But let's start with Roy Moore. This comes just a month before the special election that he's running in to win the Senate seat previously held by the Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Mm-hmm. And this story has been firing up social media. What's been some of the reaction?
Let me just tell you what Roy Moore says, first of all, just so he can get a word in here. He says these allegations are completely false, desperate political attack by the National Democrat Party and the Washington Post on this campaign. Here, senators, though, are reacting quite fiercely. Listen out for the one word that goes through a lot of their comments. It's the word if. Senator Collins from Maine. If there is any truth at all to these horrific allegations, Roy Moore should immediately step aside as a Senate candidate. That was on Twitter. Jeff Flake, senator from Arizona, also tweets, if there was any shred of truth to the allegations against Roy Moore, he should step aside immediately. Many senators are all saying the same thing. He needs to step down if the allegations are true.
John McCain, by the way, didn't include that if, and people were pointing that out yesterday on
Twitter.
Absolutely. But some are defending Roy Moore. Alabama Republican State Auditor Jim Ziegler came to Moore's defense, saying in an interview with the Washington Examiner that there's nothing immoral or illegal here. And last night on The Late Show, host Stephen Colbert made light of Ziegler's reasoning.
He said, take Joseph and Mary. Mary was a teenager, and Joseph was an adult carpenter. They became the parents of Jesus. Yeah, because Joseph didn't touch her. Their whole deal is that there was no funny business. She was the Virgin Mary. Okay?
Femi, what's been the reaction to that defense? That's real, by the way. He's saying something that actually was said.
Yeah, absolutely. It's what social media is doing right now is teetering between the jokes and how serious sexual harassment is. Again, just going back to you mentioned John McCain. He said, step aside and allow the people of Alabama to elect a candidate that they can be proud of. So there are the jokes, but there also is the very serious situation where a lot of people on social media are saying, we believe the women, we believe the accusers.
Well, we just heard there from Stephen Colbert, and speaking of Colbert, comedian Louis C.K. was supposed to be on his show last night, but that appearance was canceled after sexual misconduct allegations against him surfaced in the New York Times. Colbert was criticized by some for appearing to go easy on Louis C.K. in his monologue last night, but another late night host, Trevor Noah, over at The Daily Show, didn't hold back. Here he is.
At this point, we're going to need a new Oscar category this year. Best actor whose movies we can't watch anymore. And, you know, in fact, now that I think about it, all women in Hollywood should win double Oscars for acting like all the men were cool all along. Every single one of them. It's insane.
Femi, tell us more about the allegations here against Louis C.K. and what the response has been.
Broken by the New York Times. If you go to the New York Times Twitter feed, they have pinned their story to the top of their Twitter feed, so you don't even have to look for it. Exclusive. Five women tell NYT, New York Times, that Louis C.K. crossed the line into sexual misconduct. And for the last few weeks, if you ever see a story at the New York Times and it's pinned there, very often whoever is the main subject of that story is in deep trouble. Scott Stenholm, responds to the story that's going out right now about Louis C.K. He says, I was told this first story in this piece over 10 years ago by people I will not name. These women are telling the truth. And just to tell you a little bit about what happened, they were having a meeting with Louis C.K., two female script writers, and he stripped off and in a very inappropriate way. If there's a more appropriate way to strip off, I'm not too sure what that would be in a business meeting. But they saw more than they were expecting. Let's put it that way.
And by the way, we have some news today that Louis C.K. Says the allegations of sexual misconduct against him are true, and he expresses remorse. So we'll keep watching that story. Femi O.K., host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thank you so much. Tomorrow is Veterans Day, and we want to mark that with the story of two brothers who served side by side in the Army in Vietnam, Chuck and Tom Hagel. They came back with very different views about the war. Eventually, Chuck Hagel became a Republican senator and Secretary of Defense, Tom a lawyer and professor. Retired Lieutenant General Daniel Bolger writes about the Hagels in the new book, Our Year of War, Two Brothers, Vietnam, and a Nation Divided. He joins us from Washington along with Chuck and Tom Hagel. Welcome to all of you. And Chuck Hagel, let me start with you. You and your brother basically volunteered to be drafted. Why did you want to serve?
In those days, you, if you were not in college or had a deferment, then you were facing the very real prospect of joining a branch of service or being drafted. Most of the draftees went into the Army. I had gone to three colleges, hadn't done particularly well in any of them, was working. Draft board called me home and said, you got 6 months to get back into college or you'll get drafted. And I said, well, I don't think it's in the interest of any respectable educational institution to take me back. It'd be a waste of time for all of us. When's the soonest I could get on a bus and leave? I left the end of that that month in April of 1967. I felt some responsibility. I think all of us growing up during the 50s and 60s, when most of us had fathers, mothers, grandfathers, grandmothers in World War II, some obligation to help our country, but it was the right time for me. So that's essentially why I did what I did and why and how it all came together.
Tom Hagel, what about you?
I was in high school and I got my draft notice and I passed my physical. And again, I was told that I was going to be inducted within, I think it was 6 months. And was not going to wait around for 6 months, so I volunteered to go right after high school. I was in the Army, I think it was 5 days after I graduated. And in regard to you know, this idea of volunteering, our father, for example, was in World War II, and our uncles and extended family members. And in my mind, it was a matter of basically every generation has their war, and it was our time. So You go in. You do what you need to do.
And what about your opinions about the war at that point?
I knew so little about it that I'm sure I didn't even have an opinion. It was war. The United States says that we have to go there and help out this one country. And I was so young, so unsophisticated, so uninformed that I really had no thought about the right or wrong or the wisdom of the whole thing.
And what about you, Chuck Hagel?
Yeah, I think it was the same for me. You just did what you had to do. If the country said this was the right thing to do, you believed your country, you believed that you could make a difference, and you were expected to make a difference. So I think Tom said it exactly right.
So you're both in Vietnam in 1968, serving in the same rifle platoon during the Tet Offensive. Brutal fighting. You save each other's lives multiple times. I was wondering as I was reading this, what is it like to have your own life at stake, of course, but also your brother's? And I mean, what do you spend more time thinking about, your own safety or the safety of your brother?
Well, for me, it was, you know, I guess you'd call it split attention. Obviously, and you're in the middle of something, you're worried about survival. But in the situation we were in, I was always keeping an eye out for Chuck. He was doing the same for me and, you know, hoping that, first of all, nothing happens. And secondly, if something happens, it happens to you instead of him.
Yeah, I think Tom said it exactly right. And I think also, at least for me, and I think Tom felt this way, that if something did happen to your brother, you were there and maybe you could give a little extra attention or a little extra help or somehow maybe shield your brother from anything worse happening. And I think we both felt that way.
And Dan Bolger, as you were putting this book together, what did you discover about these two guys fighting in the war in Vietnam?
Well, I think the thing that it showed is something we all know, is the importance of family. And family is tied to the concept of service for both of these brothers, not only at the time of the Vietnam War, where they followed the example of their father and their other relatives, as they mentioned, but also through the rest of their lives. I mean, both these men have dedicated themselves to lives of public service. They carried that with them. And that's a great example. I know it's a great example to me, but I think it's also a reason why their story needs to be known.
So, Tom Hagel, how did your experience in the war change the way that you viewed the war?
Well, after I was there for a while, and keep in mind that I was 18 years old, barely graduated from high school, and after a while, I started questioning what we were doing there and how we were doing it. I would, for example, see all of us in our unit head out to situations where we knew we were going to have contact with the enemy, and we'd be going over a bridge where the South Vietnamese soldiers would be sitting there or laying there in hammocks with their families just taking in the sun. And after a while, it made me ask the question, you know, why are we taking the brunt of the responsibility of this war when we have so many of these Vietnamese soldiers who seem to be holding back? Then, of course, the rampant corruption over there. You could buy yourself out of the war if you're in the South Vietnamese Army. I mean, it's legendary, the corruption in the government. And all of that became known over time. And I think a lot of people had the same questions. And I got to the point where I felt, well, you know, I'm torn here. I have my duties. These are my buddies, my brother, are my troops, and I'm going to do what I can to survive, number one, for myself, but also for them. I owe them a duty, even though I hate what I'm doing and I don't believe anymore what I'm doing, but I got to do it for them just so that hopefully all of us can get out of here, because it just seemed like a hopeless task. We would go in, for example, and clear a village out of the Viet Cong and then leave, and then 2 weeks later we'd go back in and do the same thing. Over and over and over again. It was pointless.
Is that how you felt, Chuck Hagel?
No, I saw exactly what Tom saw. I had strong feelings as well. He and I used to talk about it. But when you're in war, you don't let that other dimension that Tom has just noted overtake the obligation and responsibility you have looking out for each other and your buddies. Where it hit me later on more and more vividly than at any time was when I listened to the tapes. In fact, I think I first heard them on NPR back in the 90s, between Johnson and his generals and Secretary of Defense McNamara and members of Congress, when it was clear that our leaders of our country were lying and were deceiving the American people and were costing thousands and thousands of lives in this senseless endeavor. And that's where I certainly turned in a new direction and saw it then as vividly and clearly as Tom had seen it earlier.
But even before that, after you guys got back from the war, you shared an apartment and ended up getting into a fight. The police were called from your disagreements.
Yes. I think that just shows you the depth of impact it had on both of us. We believed so strongly because, quite frankly, it was for both of us a life-changing experience. The two of us that went in, two different people came out. I had so much anger and depression over the whole thing that it just was dealt with in the wrong way. Chuck had just as strong feelings where he was coming from.
Now, we are obviously still at war right now as a nation in Iraq, in Afghanistan.
And we didn't learn anything.
Well, that's what I want to ask you. What do you think that we learned any lessons from Vietnam?
Well, one lesson I think that we may have learned is that now we're better at separating the war from the warrior, meaning you can be against the war but still support the people who are fighting it. not necessarily because they want to fight it. They're serving their country. They're doing the best they can, so they deserve our support and our respect, while at the same time we can have open criticism of the politicians who basically lied to us to get us into the war.
Chuck Hagel, what do you think?
Well, I think there are similarities between Vietnam and what we are continuing to experience in Iraq and Afghanistan today. We are now moving into our 17th year in Afghanistan. We're back in Iraq after many years. We're in Syria now. We're in Africa, not in just advisory roles, but in a pretty significant, maybe technically not combat roles, but in fact, when you're in these countries and you're in these hostile areas, it is combat. I think those are some similarities that we should have learned some lessons from Vietnam. And I think the bottom line of that, I would define it with this point. The military cannot fix problems. The military can help be part of a diplomatic, a strategic objective, but it is the people in the areas, whether it's Afghanistan, Iraq, Vietnam, have to sort their own differences out and have to take control of their own lives and their own future. We can help, and it's in our interest to help, of course. But once you get so deep into a country that the military is essentially not only advising and working on behalf of a government or a people, but in fact in charge of the institutions and the power behind the ability of a government in those countries to operate, then you're in too deep. And that means to me you've probably not learned the lessons of Vietnam.
That's Chuck Hagel. We've also been speaking with his brother Tom and Dan Bolger, author of Our Year of War, Two Brothers, Vietnam, and A Nation Divided. Thanks to all of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can find an excerpt from the book at hereandnow.org. Senate Republicans have released their version of the tax overhaul bill, following the House of Representatives version, which should get a vote next week. The Senate version of the bill has some key differences from the House version. Among them, the Senate is asking for a one-year delay on cutting the corporate tax rate, which has been one of President Trump's top priorities. Republican leaders have said they want to get a bill through quickly before the end of the year. Michael Regan joins us now. He's senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with the corporate tax cut delay that I mentioned. The markets were down yesterday on that news. Why does the Senate want to do this?
Well, Congress's latest budget includes a requirement that the tax cuts cannot add more than $1.5 trillion to the deficit over 10 years. And the Senate really wants to keep some of the deductions that the House plan gets rid of. So by delaying the corporate tax cut by a year, it would allow the government to recoup about $100 billion of revenue. And that would allow them to maintain those other popular deductions while still coming in at less than that $1.5 trillion deficit limit.
But both of the plans, the House plan and the Senate plan, would get rid of those state and local tax deductions, which experts say would hurt taxpayers in California, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, some of those states. How are the plans different other than that?
Well, the Senate plan is a straight up repeal of the deductions for state and local taxes, including income, sales and property tax deductions. On the other hand, the House plan would repeal the deductions for state and local income and sales taxes, but it would keep the property tax deductions. It would cap them at $10,000, though, so still not likely to make all the homeowners in the coastal states happy, but a big difference.
What are some of the other big differences between the Senate and the House version?
There really are quite a few. The House wants to repeal the medical expense deductions, whereas the Senate wants to maintain it. And the same thing with the student loan interest deductions. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. There are several others.
There's another one that I noticed last week. It didn't get very much attention, but there's an electric car tax credit that the House version wanted to get rid of. The Senate, I think, keeps it in.
Right. And, you know, politically, you have to sort of put your shoes into the, you know, put your feet into the shoes of a senator or House member. If you're a House of Representatives member, you only really have to worry about the voters in your district. whereas the senators have to worry about the whole state. So that sort of pushes the senators more towards the middle, towards the center. And that's why a lot of them are more in favor of some of these widely popular deductions that might not be popular in various representatives' districts.
So what's the likelihood of passage at this point? The House wants to vote next week. You know, Thanksgiving is coming up. That was a deadline that they set. And lawmakers are saying they want this signed by President Trump by Christmas.
Yeah, that still seems fairly far-fetched that it'll actually get to the president's desk by Christmas. They're just so far apart on so many of these deductions that, the market's reaction, as you pointed out, is very much that they're not quite there yet. It'll take a while longer.
But do you think that it has a good chance of passage right now?
I think it's a tough call. I mean, if you look at what happened with the Obamacare repeal and replace effort, I don't think anyone's 100% optimistic that right. It can be passed. So it's going to be in the headlines for a while to come.
Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thank you.
Thank you.
Today, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson warned against countries and groups in the Middle East using Lebanon as a proxy for conflict, a message to rivals Iran and Saudi Arabia, a day after Saudi Arabia told its citizens in Lebanon to leave the country immediately, and less than a week after the unexpected resignation of the Lebanese prime minister. Joining us from Beirut is the BBC's Karine Torby. And Karine, what reasons did the Saudi government give for issuing that warning yesterday, and what's the situation today in Beirut?
Well, it remains very fluid in terms of what the Saudis want or what the Saudis fear from about the situation in Lebanon. They did not justify the reasons behind their call for their citizens to leave Lebanon immediately. But this comes in the context of mounting escalation between Saudi Arabia and Lebanon, after Saudi Arabia has said that it considers that the government of Lebanon is a government of war against Saudi Arabia. And it is launching a very scathing attack against the government, specifically against Hezbollah. And it seems not to distinguish anymore between Hezbollah, the Shia group that has very strong links to Iran, and the Lebanese government, which is at this point considered as probably the most serious escalation from Saudi Arabia towards Lebanon.
And the context here is that it was about a week ago that the Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri went to Saudi Arabia ostensibly for meetings and then abruptly resigned, saying that he feared for his life. He has not returned to Lebanon. Do we know anything about his whereabouts?
Well, this is the main question in the country. We know that Saad Hariri is in Saudi Arabia. Lebanon believes, and this is like the official position in Lebanon, that Saad Hariri might be under house arrest in Saudi Arabia. As you said, the last week has seen extraordinary events in Lebanon. Saad Hariri on last Saturday, resigned in a surprise move that was even very surprising to his inner circle. And the resignation came from Saudi Arabia, where he read a televised speech in which he launched a very, very strong narrative or attack against Iran. Ever since, there has been no contact between the prime minister and the members of the government in Lebanon or the president himself, prompting the Lebanese government to think that Saad al-Hariri might not be free to talk or might not be free to return to Lebanon. That's why, at the moment, Lebanon is asking for the return of Saad al-Hariri as a primary condition before dealing or agreeing to tackle any other issue in the country.
And another detail that we should mention here is that Saad Hariri's father, Rafiq Hariri, was assassinated back in 2005.
That's correct. Saad al-Hariri inherited the leadership of his father. It's true that Saad al-Hariri mentioned in his resignation speech that he felt that his life is probably under threat and there are some assassination attempts against him. But the Lebanese government and all the security bodies in Lebanon, from the army to the police to all sorts of bodies, have confirmed that they have absolutely no idea about any information about any such attempt or any such plot against any political figure in Lebanon.
How does Israel fit into this? I was reading that some of the statements from Israeli officials and Saudi officials were almost identical after Hariri stepped down.
Absolutely. We have seen some similarity in the Saudi speeches and the Israeli speeches, and we have heard some welcoming comments from the Israelis to this movement or to this speech that Hariri delivered from Riyadh last Saturday.
And that is because Israel and Saudi Arabia are both on the same page when it comes to disliking Iran.
Absolutely. They seem to be not only on the same page, they seem to be, there are some suspicions that they might be coordinating when it comes to the way to deal with Iran. There are some reports that Saudi Arabia has been asking Israel to take a more active stance towards Hezbollah in Lebanon.
One more thing. We know that President Trump has given support to the Saudis and what they've been doing. What about French President Emmanuel Macron? He visited Saudi Arabia yesterday. Do we know anything about what happened there?
We're still waiting to hear about the outcome of his visit. We know that he is in Saudi Arabia. We know that Lebanon and the situation in Lebanon, the situation of the Prime Minister, Saad al-Hariri, is very high up on the agenda, on the discussions. But so far, we haven't heard from the president himself about the outcome of his meetings in Saudi Arabia.
The BBC's Karine Torby in Beirut. Many of the American service members who have been wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan suffer from polytrauma, a medical term that refers to situations in which there is more than one serious injury. The lessons learned from treating those complex wounds led to a new model of care that today is helping active duty personnel and veterans heal, whether they have seen combat or not. Wendy Rigby from Texas Public Radio has the story.
Air Force veteran William Geralds knows the meaning of the phrase hard work.
Up again?
He's being put through the ringer by a physical therapist at the Polytrauma Rehabilitation Center at San Antonio's VA hospital.
If you don't give up, they don't give up.
Let's do three more for me.
Geralds could have easily given up 8 years ago. At age 61, he developed viral pneumonia that triggered a rare side effect, the autoimmune disorder called Guillain-Barré syndrome.
I couldn't talk. I was paralyzed and on life support. The only things that moved were my eyes and my big toe on my left foot.
Geralds' service qualified him for treatment at this specialized facility, the newest of five in the country. It's part of an effort to develop a better way to care for people with multiple injuries from modern combat, explains rehab medicine physician Dr. Elizabeth Halmai.
What we were seeing at that time is not just traumatic brain injury, but it would be traumatic brain injury plus amputations, plus spinal cord injuries, plus burns.
Treating any one of these problems is difficult, but altogether it becomes exponentially more challenging. About 100 people a year come to polytrauma rehab here. They work with an elaborate team of specialists, physical, occupational, and speech therapists, eye doctors, psychologists, and social workers. Donna Balderston was with the National Guard Active Reserve for 30 years.
And having this program here is absolutely vital.
For Balderston, a simple bike ride became life-altering.
I was cycling, and I had a heart attack and got hit by a car.
Balderston had broken bones, a cardiac issue, and a traumatic brain injury that landed her at the Polytrauma Center. After about 9 months, first as an inpatient, then in a transition unit, she considers herself at 90%.
They did speech therapy with me. They did physical therapy with me. They did mental health therapy with me to make sure that I can come back and be 100% again.
12 years ago, when the polytrauma centers first started treating patients, almost all were active duty troops. Today, it's 50-50, half active military, half veterans. The center boasts a high rate of patients who return to school and work. Several returned to active duty.
Good girl. Yes.
For paralyzed patient Gerald's, it was about returning to independence. He's in a wheelchair much of the time, but he can move, use a walker at times, and talk. His service dog, 3-year-old boxer Tammy, is trained to pick up things he drops.
Hold it up.
Told he would never be able to feed himself or stand upright, Gerald's is beating the odds. The old veteran says he's honored to heal alongside young troops recovering from battle wounds.
The most humbling thing is being able to work with all these young people that are coming back from combat.
Everybody still needs a purpose.
That's Polytrauma Medical Director Dr. Elizabeth Hallmai again.
Everybody still needs to have meaning in their life, whatever that is going to look like for them.
Since the inception, the 5 polytrauma rehab centers have provided personal, time-intensive care to more than 3,500 people. The lessons learned are now being published so that civilians can benefit from advances in care. For Here and Now, I'm Wendy Rigby in San Antonio.
This week, United Airlines said goodbye to the Boeing 747 with a farewell flight from San Francisco to Hawaii, recalling the flight the first United 747 took back in 1970. To pay tribute, the flight attendants' uniforms, the menu, and entertainment all had a 70s theme. One passenger took the opportunity to propose to his girlfriend, who said yes. United's flight was sold out within hours, a sign of the devotion that many aviation fans have for the plane once called the Queen of the Skies. Delta is also retiring the 747 this year, which means no North American passenger airline will be operating the 747. In January, I spoke with Clive Irving, the aviation correspondent for The Daily Beast and author of the book Wide Body, The Triumph of the 747. We spoke by Skype, and I asked him why these airlines were retiring the 747.
This all goes down to one thing, that when an airline looks at an airplane now, when they look at buying a new airplane, they're not actually looking at an airplane, they're looking at a business plan, business model, actually. They want the most efficient combination of several things. They want a set number of passengers to go a set distance. And that's a fairly demanding equation these days. So basically, Boeing have been very smart, and they've made their own plane obsolescent, if not obsolete, by producing a version of the slightly smaller 777, the Boeing 777, that's far more fuel efficient over virtually the same distances as a 747, carries slightly fewer people. The 777 being a much more modern plane, therefore it's much more fuel efficient. So the numbers make a lot of sense.
So it's a more fuel efficient plane. Could they have made a new version, though, of the 747 that would be more fuel efficient and still have that little, iconic second floor hump in the front of the plane?
Yeah, isn't that a wonderful part of the character? Yeah. The plane has a very identifiable and recognizable profile. Well, they did actually make a later version called the 747-8, which was produced 5 or 6 years ago. They hoped that they could compete with their own 777, and it turned out that they couldn't. So that latest version of the 747 is going to end up as a cargo carrier, basically. That's what it's being sold as, and not as a passenger plane. It's all about size. You've got 3 sizes of planes. You've got the 777 and the Airbus A350, which are long-haul planes carrying around 400 people going up to, say, 6,000 or 7,000 miles in distance. Then below them, you've got another category, which is by far the largest category, which is the single aisle, because the ones I've just mentioned are all wide bodies. You go down to 185 to 200 people, which is split between Airbus with the A320 and 321 and Boeing with the 737. and I'll tell you something fascinating about the 737 in a minute. And then below that, you've got a category which Boeing and Airbus, which is basically a duopoly, planes with 108 to 130 seats. Now, the fascinating thing about the 737, which is the largest money spinner Boeing has ever made, was it was designed by the same people at the same time as the 747 in the late 1960s. And it turned out to be an amazing cash cow. They keep adapting it, making it slightly larger, putting more efficient engines on it. So you've got a contrast between one plane, which is the 747, which is absolutely a game changer in long-haul international flying, and another one, which is sort of much more modest and unsung, which is, in fact, Boeing's biggest money spinner. Hmm.
Well, you also have the 747 as the plane for Air Force One. This is the plane that the president flies on. What was so special about it that it became the gold standard, at least for the president of the United States?
Well, it became the gold standard for everybody, really, in terms of safety and comfort. It's not exaggerating to say that the 747 transformed the whole idea of flying around the world, because when it was introduced, it was a third more fuel efficient than what had gone before it. And it was the first plane really to democratize. It introduced something entirely new to the human experience, which was the economic availability of international air travel to large numbers of people. So in that sense, it's been an enormous force for good, for people experiencing other countries and other cultures. It was a machine for doing that. And it can't be overestimated, the effect that that plane had. And then, as you said, it was a kind of, almost had a personality of its own when it nosed towards the airport gate and you saw that great bulbous upper deck there. Actually, obviously, I've written a book about it, so I know it quite intimately. I still feel when I go aboard it that it's very special. There's nothing else quite like it.
What's going to be the thing you'll miss most about the 747?
Ah, that's a very good question. I think just the feel of its personality. It's so rock solid and stable. When it comes into land, for example, it looks as though it's flying about 50 miles an hour because it's so big, it's actually flying 150 miles an hour. And I just think there are very few machines these days, cars or planes, that you can develop a personal attachment to. And I still think it's possible to do that with the 747.
That's Clive Irving, aviation correspondent for the Daily Beast and author of the book Wide Body, The Triumph of the 747. Clive, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.